So we're looking at what Jesus is doing, right? In Luke 4, verse 18, he says, I came. He said, I came, and the Spirit of the Lord is on me to preach the gospel to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, and to set at liberty those who are oppressed. So this morning we want to talk about Jesus Christ came to heal the brokenhearted. He came to heal the brokenhearted. Now, in one sense, all of these phrases deal with brokenness, because when he said, I came to preach the gospel to the poor, that's financial brokenness. And then when he said he came to preach deliverance to the captives, that's really spiritual brokenness. And then when he says, I came to preach, to bring sight to the blind, that's really intellectual brokenness. Those are people that aren't seeing what they should be seeing. And then when he says, I came to set the oppressed free, or to deliver the oppressed, that's really, in a great sense, emotional brokenness. So in all of these cases, we're really talking about Jesus coming to deal with broken people. One place he, in fact, said, he said, I did not come for the well, but for the sick. Remember, he said, the sick don't need a doctor. So I didn't come, the well don't need a doctor. He said, I didn't come for the people whose lives were going good. I didn't come for the well. I didn't come for the healthy. I came for the sick. I came for the broken. And what's true about my life and in your life is we're never going to find them unless we realize that there's brokenness in there. We find them at our point of need, right? Didn't come for the well. As long as you don't have any problems, as long as everything's fine, as long as you got nothing to hide, he didn't come for you. But the day comes when you see that you need to be forgiven and you need to be cleansed and you need a Savior, then he came for you. And here it says that he came to heal the brokenhearted. Now, what's he driving at? What does it mean to be brokenhearted? When he says, I came to heal, I came to bind up, I came to bandage up the brokenhearted, what's he talking about? What does it mean to be brokenhearted? And I think in the best sense of the word, to be brokenhearted really means to be without hope, doesn't it? I mean, when something happens in your life, and your heart breaks, what happens is not just that your heart breaks, not just that you have loss. Sometimes we think we're grieving the loss, but it's not the loss in and of itself that we're grieving. We're grieving the future that was lost. We're grieving the hope that got dashed. Look at it like this. Think about the times that you would say, I was brokenhearted. Think about the time that you got broken up with for the very first time. I remember that. I had a little thing for a girl for about 10 years, starting from the age of 6 to the age of 16. A little thing for her. And 16, she had a little thing for me for 6 weeks. And but for 10 years, I'd thought about that girl, and I dreamed about the time that she would, you know, recognize I was the man for her. And I'm so glad she didn't, because she made an absolute mess of her life and it would have been a disaster. But in any case, for 10 years, and I, you know, had a picture of the house and the kids and how we would live for, you know, I'm 16. What I know, I'm a teeny bopper, right? And so I have all this in my mind, and 6 weeks after she says yes, she says, oh no, it's not what I want. And it was awful, just horrendous. I remember crying, and I had a CD. It was a Chris Isaak CD. Nobody gets you through heartache like Chris Isaak. And the CD is Forever Blue, and all the songs just identify with breakups. So, you know, I think the first song in there is Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing, you know. And then there's a song on there called Graduation Day. And it's like an in-your-face song. It's like, you didn't dump me, I graduated from you. How do you like that? And, you know, just trying to turn it. But I remember all the pain and the heartache, but it wasn't just her. It was sort of like the hopes and dreams that we would be together and all the picket fence and the life we would live together. That's sort of what got dashed. And I'm glad it did. Nothing like a redhead. Nothing like a junk. Sometimes you're not a teeny bopper. Sometimes you stand up before a preacher and you say, for better or worse, sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer. And you just assume that the person who's up there saying across from you, for better or worse, means for better or worse, that they wouldn't lie before God and all their friends and family. And the truth is that they probably don't realize all that better or worse could mean. They don't realize worse could mean really bad, at least in their mind. And you invest 15, 20 years in that relationship, and they walk out on you, and you're completely, absolutely devastated, brokenhearted. Why? Because you've lost something, yes, but because you took them at their word, and you believed that you would grow old and that you would die together, and you believed that you would have kids and grandkids together and that you would be together, and the future is lost to you. The hope is dashed. Maybe you're a parent and you know you have those moments. They're coming for me. They've come for some of you where you have to in some way grieve the loss of the childhood of your children. And maybe that's graduation day for you. Maybe that's dropping them off at college. Maybe that's when you walk them down the aisle. And I hear it doesn't feel so hot. That's what I hear. And I could see it when my dad would walk my daughters down the aisle and cry. So I could see something was going on there. But there is a sense in which you're grieving the fact that your children aren't children anymore and that part of your life has passed. But I think probably to some degree, as I think of a father walking his daughter down the aisle, it's like you would be thinking, well, she's going to belong to somebody else now. I'm now the second guy in her life. Her life is moving away from me. She's going to get a lot more independent. I'm going to become far less important to her as the years go on. She's leaving and cleaving and going towards her husband, and she's going away from me. And there is a sense maybe that that's a wake-up call that, you know, the future that you had planned where you would all be together and be really, really tight and happy till the rest of your life, that's not entirely how this is going to work out. This has future implications. Maybe you've lost a loved one. You've stood at the casket, they've died, they've gone on, and you've lost them, but now you've got to reprogram everything that the future looks like because you planned on them being there when you scored the touchdown, you planned on them being there when you succeeded or when you failed. You just in your mind planned that if things went wrong, they would be there for you, and now the whole future of your life looks so different than it did a week ago. Brokenheartedness is about loss, but it's also about the loss of the future. It's about the loss of a dream. It's about the loss of a vision. See, if you can have loss, but if you don't envision yourself with them in the future, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt. I was watching an episode of Seinfeld the other day, and Jerry's talking to Elaine, and he's there with a girl, and she comes in and says, "How long have you been with her?" The girl leaves, and he says, "Well, you know, since the last one." And the girl ends up breaking up with him at the end of the episode, but you know, he's fine, and he goes out the door of the cafe humming, "She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes." And see, if you don't envision a future with somebody, if it's just somebody in your life, you don't grieve it. But when you start to picture the future, that's where you're very susceptible to the heartbreak. I was talking with my brother a few years ago, and my brother just turned 50, and he has 3-year-old twins and a son that will be 1 year old in a few months. So he started very late in life here. And but he and his wife had several miscarriages a few years ago. And he and I are very close, and we're talking after one of the miscarriages. And we've had a miscarriage since then, so I get sort of what that's like, but not to the degree that he experienced it. He lost the child, I think maybe 6 or 8 weeks. So I'm talking, and I'm sort of surprised at how hard he was taking it. Now, that's insensitivity on my part, I realize that, but I just couldn't grasp where he was coming from at that time. 6 to 8 weeks didn't seem to me like such a large loss. The baby didn't have a sex yet. It didn't have a profile. These things happen. But boy, he was really taking it very hard. And I asked him, I said, why are you taking it this hard? 6, 8 weeks. Why would you take a miscarriage like this? And he said, here's the thing. When you find out you're going to have a baby, that day you begin to think about names. And that night you go home and you start to look around your house and you start to see, well, that's got to change. I think this room will be better for the nursery, and we're going to have to do a lot of work before he gets here or she gets here. He said, you go to Walmart and you find yourself, instead of going to the fishing poles, you pass by the bike aisle and you say to yourself, boy, if it's a boy, I think I'm going to buy this bike, you know, if that's the way it works out. He said, from the minute you find out you're going to have a baby, you start dreaming, you start hoping, you start picturing the future. And he said, I guess that's what hurts the most. We know that that's not going to happen. See, brokenheartedness is just not about the loss. It's about the dashing of the dream, the loss of the vision, the rearranging of the future. It's about the loss of hope. In fact, there's a place in Proverbs chapter 13:12. We're going to put it up. I like it in the new, in the Good News Bible. We didn't have that program on our computer, but in the Good News Bible, it says this: when hope is crushed, your heart is crushed. When hope is crushed, your heart is crushed. You lose hope, it breaks your heart. This one, in the New King James Version, it says, hope deferred, or hope pushed away, or hope pushed aside, makes the heart sick. But when the desire comes, it is a tree of life. But notice, if the hope breaks, the heart breaks. The heart breaks is because the hope has been broken in your life. But the Bible says that Jesus Christ came to heal the brokenhearted. Came to heal the brokenhearted. Now, how does he do that? And I don't know that there's one way or three ways. I think there's probably about 1,000 ways that Jesus is able to mend a broken heart. But I want to share with you 3 because I'm a preacher, and 3 is the number of preachers. One way that Jesus in the Bible heals brokenhearted people is that he gives you a vision. And that vision is simply that all the things you're losing, you're not losing. You might be losing some things, that's true, but you're actually gaining. He takes the losses and he puts them in a perspective where he shows you that the losses are necessary for a better future. And really, you think you're losing and you're grieving the loss and you're looking at the future and you're saying, I've lost these things and I don't have a future and I'm going to have, there's no hope and it's going to be miserable. But he gives you insight into how the things that you are counting as loss are really gain. And he gives you a vision of that. There's a place in the Old Testament, and there's a lot of these places, but there's a guy named Joseph. And Joseph should have been drinking by the time he was 17. He lost his mother at the age of 7. His mother died in childbirth. He lost his mother as a young child. He was raised in a family of all boys. His brothers hated him so much that at the age of 17, they plotted to kill him, but one brother spoke up on his behalf, so they sold him into slavery. He was very close to his brother, his father, because his father doted on him, I think because his father, had sympathy because he had lost his mother in the way that the other boys had not. And so the father had invested in him. They're very, very close. He doesn't think he'll ever see his father again. Some bad things happen. He ends up in prison for about 10 years. And if you can just think about Joseph in prison, lost his mother. He didn't have a family to begin with. He was never accepted into his family. He's never going to see his father again. And for all he knows, he's going to die in prison. That's where life had taken him. Loss after loss after loss after loss. But something happened. He got well. What began to mend his brokenness? God showed him something. By the time his brothers show up in Genesis 50, he says to his brothers in verse 20, he said, "The things you meant for loss, God meant for gain. The things that I thought were loss, my whole life was about grieving the losses, but really the Lord has showed me that if it hadn't been for this happening, that wouldn't have happened, and then that wouldn't have happened, and then that wouldn't have happened, and now I am here, I'm prime minister of Egypt, which was the most powerful country in the world at the time, and now I am able to help my family and my father. He has brought me to the very echelons of power, but it couldn't have happened without the loss. I thought I was getting beat down, but with every loss, I was taking one step up. I thought I was being pushed back, but every loss was driving me forward and upward. And the Lord has let me see that in my life. And so my hopes weren't being dashed, but my dreams were being made. And now I get a vision of it. I can see it clearly." Sometimes God just mends your brokenness by showing you, hey, what are you grieving about? It looks like loss to you, but this is gain. If you could see it from my point of view, I'm working all things out for your good. My father grew up in a really dysfunctional household. And I think I've talked about him some here over the last year. But he never knew his real father. He grew up with a very violent stepfather. And the guy had served time in prison for manslaughter. He beat a man to death in a bar fight. And but he was very violent. He wasn't a nice guy when he wasn't drinking, but when he drank, things got very bad. And my father has memories of being 8, 9, 10 years old and seeing his mother pinned against a wall with a shotgun in her mouth, with him threatening to blow her brains out. While all the little, my father was the oldest one. He's 8, so all the other kids are younger. And he's sitting there on the couch making him look at that and cry and beg for their mother. He remembers when he was 10 years old. He thought that he was going to kill his mother, so he drove. It was snowing in Steubenville, Ohio. He got in the family car, and the tire was flat. But he drove, 10 years old, a family car with a flat tire all the way to the police department to get the police to come out and save his mom. And those were back, that was back in the 50s. So the police ran back to the house, sirens wailing, and he's driving the car behind the police car, 10 years old with a flat tire. Things were a little different back then. And but that was sort of his life. He had an uncle in his life, my grandmother's brother, who was moving up in life. He later became a doctor, but he was in medical school at that time, and he wanted to adopt my dad and to bring him out of that lifestyle, to give him a future. And he asked my grandmother time and time again to let him adopt Ron, and he would be his son. But my grandmother would never release my dad from that house because she loved him too much. You get that? And in the end, she abandoned the kids and left all the kids with the stepfather. But she, at that point, loved my dad too much to let him leave the situation. So, but we've talked about what his life would have been like if he had been adopted by a doctor and the advantages that he would have probably had that he didn't simply have growing up. He ran away from home when he was 15, finally, and went to Arkansas and met and married my mom when he was 17. And the first years of his life weren't very good. But we talked about how his life would have been so different if he had been adopted out of that by a loving uncle. And to this day, what he will say to you is, my life would have probably been more financially successful. I would have gone to, you know, good colleges and that kind of thing, which that just wasn't possible where I grew up. He said, the way I grew up put a brokenness in me that drove me to God. He said, I also met my mother, he met my mother because of the way that he grew up. He ran away from home and met her in Bradford, Arkansas, and that would have never happened. He wouldn't have met mom if it hadn't gone that way. But he will say to you today, he will say, the brokenness in my life drove me to God and later brought me into the ministry because I wanted to help people that had gone through what I had gone through. And he will say to you, I wouldn't trade the ministry for $10 million. What helps the brokenness of his life? Does he look at that early family and does it just break his heart? It does to some extent, but the Lord has given him, at least in his view, understanding that it had to be that way to get him to Jesus. And that's something the Lord has shown to him, and it has helped the heartbreak in his life. Remember what Paul said in Philippians 3? He's talking about all the things he lost in life. In verse 7, he talks about how he was a Jew of the Jews. He was a teacher, great education, Pharisee of the Pharisees, spotless before the law. He said, but I threw it all away. So in verse 8, he says, so I might gain Christ. He was looking at all his losses and he was saying, but I really didn't lose because all that stuff got me to Christ, and Jesus Christ is a pearl of great price, and everything that I've gone through to get to Jesus was worth it because I got the pearl of great price. Amen. Sometimes Jesus takes it all and he puts it in perspective for you, and you thought you were losing, but you were winning every step of the way. Sometimes he just draws near to you, and this point too. Sometimes he just draws near to you and he comforts you with his understanding. Nothing comforts you like somebody who understands. Nothing does. I knew a man, he passed away a few years ago, but he invested a lot in my early ministry. He was a retired pastor who spent most of his time in Ohio. He was a World War II vet and a great guy. And he told me something, and I had to take his word for it, and you'll have to take my word for this. But the worst period of his life was when he was 43 years old. He had a son named Bruce, and Bruce was in an auto accident, and his neck was broken. He was paralyzed from the neck down. And most miserable time of Joe Smith's life. After weeks and months of hospitalization, came home, and he had to be turned over every 2 hours during the night. And so Joe was there and turned his son over every 2 hours. Joe would say, I went to my office every day at the church, and I sat out and looked out the window and just sit and cried every day. He said, but something changed in my life. There was a turning point. And this is where you have to take my word for it, like I had to take Joe's. He said, I heard God speak audibly. And he said two words that changed my life and put me on the path to recovery. The two words were these: I understand. I understand. Something about being understood by God that begins the process of healing in your life. Oftentimes, we can't get that from other humans. Other humans, every now and then you run into somebody who might be able to begin to understand where you're at. But that doesn't happen so often. We grow up in different places. And if you grew up in a home where you weren't protected, in a home where you were abused, in a home where you were used, people who don't grow up in that situation really can't understand you. They just don't get it. They grew up in a Ozzie and Harriet upbringing, and it's hard for them to capture the brokenness that came into your life when you were 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 years old. It's hard for them to capture that. But Jesus can understand. Jesus can understand. He's omnipotent. He knows what it is like to be physically abused. He knows what it's like to be beaten. He knows what it's like to be rejected by his whole town. He knows what it's like to be rejected by the Father. He understands so much of what we go through in life. And I think he understands it all because he's omniscient. He can feel it. There are people in your life and they can't understand you because the temperaments are different. You know, I meet people who talk about getting angry and punching holes through walls and who are so angry that they could kill somebody. And I hear that and I get it, but I don't understand it because I would never punch a hole through the wall because it would cost like $200 to replace the drywall and I'm cheap. And so you'd never break. I mean, you might. But I can't understand. I'm not wired that way. I've never been wired that way. I got to do everything that I can to get up for something because I'm naturally sort of laid back. I'm not wired to have those kinds of feelings. I do sometimes, but you know, they're very fleeting in my life. A lot of people can't sympathize with unfulfilled dreams. They can't. So much, you know, I think of Hannah. Remember Hannah in the Old Testament? And she wanted a child so badly. And she begged God to give her a child. And she goes to the priest, who's an old guy named Eli. And she's wanting Eli to pray for her. Now, just imagine Hannah going to Eli. And there she is. She's this young woman, probably late teens, early 20s, wants a child. And there's Eli, this old guy in a beard. You think she got anything from Eli? I mean, the best he could do is say, honey, I will pray for you. She went home without any sympathy. What could he give her? But Jesus can give you the sympathy you need. No one understands what unfulfilled dreams feel like any better than Jesus. When you see Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 sitting and he's looking at the city of Jerusalem where he knows they're going to kill him the next time he goes in the city. And he says, I wish that I could have gathered you under my wings like a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you wouldn't let me. You feel the unfulfilled dreams coming out of him. You feel it. No one faced temptation like Jesus. You say, well, he didn't have a drug problem. He didn't have an alcohol problem. He didn't do prescription drugs. That's true. But no one faced Satan and Satan's power to any greater degree than Jesus Christ. Where you're at in that hotel room or that empty apartment, and you're wondering whether to take the pill or not. I mean, listen, what you feel isn't as strong as what Jesus felt in the Garden of Gethsemane where he said, if there be any way, let this cup pass from me. Jesus Christ took all the force of Satan. He understands what it feels like to be spiritually attacked. Jesus Christ can sympathize with us. He can understand. And there's nothing, again, that helps a broken heart any more than sympathy from somebody who gets it. That's one other way that he helps. Some way at times he takes it and he puts it in perspective. He says, all those losses you thought, all the brokenness, it wasn't brokenness. It was moving you in the right direction. You weren't losing a future. I was making a future for you. Sometimes he comes close to us and he sympathizes. Other times, and I take that back because all the time, if you're a Christian, what he does for all of us is he takes the hope of glory and he just funnels it into our lives. And as we fix our eyes on that, what it does is it allows us to rejoice even in the brokenness. There's a place in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Andrew, will you give that to us? Peter's talking and he said, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Christ Jesus from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you now greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials." Now put all that together. First of all, he says you're in the middle of various trials. The word for trials there is the same word used to describe what Jesus was going through in Gethsemane. It's not a little thing. You are being grieved to the point of death. He said, you are going through the little trials. He said, but in verse 3, you saw that. He said, but even now you have a living hope that you can rejoice in. Why? Because first of all, you have been redeemed, you have been saved, you have been brought into a right relationship with Jesus Christ. You got that now. Second of all, you have been given an inheritance which is incorruptible, that fadeth not away, reserved for you in heaven. You got that right now. And thirdly, you have the hope of glory. You're going to be with Jesus in the end. New body. Eternity, no pain, no suffering, and you've got that promise for the future. He said, now, you're in various trials now, but remember what you've already got and the hope of tremendously, infinitely more to come. He says, so because of that, even though you're in the trials, you can still rejoice. It's not as bad as it would have been. Paul said, we sorrow, but not as those without hope. We sorrow, but our hope isn't really dashed. Our future isn't really dashed because of what we have already been given. You know, it's hard for me to feel sorry for professional athletes when they lose the big game. It just is. And I realize that it was the Super Bowl and you're 35 and you'll probably never be back to the Super Bowl again. And this was your last chance. And I see that you're crying and you're sorry. And this is a terrible place. And I get the heartache. But I also get the fact that you're going back to your house in a private plane, and it's a mansion, and you're going to pack your suitcase and get in a Rolls Royce and go back to the airport, and you're going to spend a month in an exotic island to recoup from your heartbreak. And I understand the grief, and I understand the trials that you are in, but I also understand what you've got, so I'm not so sorry for you. What Paul is simply saying, or Peter is simply saying, is I know that you're in the middle of a bone-crushing heartbreak, and I get that. I understand that. And this is pushing you to the brink, and you don't know if your heart can take any more of it. I understand that.
But I also get that you are an heir of heaven. You're a friend of Jesus. You're going to spend eternity with Him. You have an inheritance already there that's worth more than all of this world has to offer. And you're going to spend eternity in heaven with God and His family. And that ought to mean something to you. Jesus comes and He heals our heartbreak by putting it in perspective. He heals our heartbreak by sympathizing with us. He heals our heartbreak by reminding us of what we already have, the hope of glory. And it doesn't mean that we don't hurt. It doesn't mean that we aren't pushed to the brink. We're going to find that we're in our own Gethsemanes in this life. But it's also great news because it means that we don't stay there. There is a balm in Gilead. There is one who heals the brokenhearted. Listen to me. You heard Philip's testimony. Sometimes when a guy like that steps up and he tells you what God has done in his life, you hear that and you say, well, that's the exception. No, that's the rule. That's the rule. That's not the exception. All the heartache in a home, lost his father, all the pain, all the brokenness. I haven't talked to Philip that much. I don't know what it was like with his father. I don't know if he envisioned his father being at the games, hunting, spending his life. He just don't know. But there was so much heartache, so much brokenness. But today, you've heard a guy who's getting healed. You may say you're healed, but you're getting healed. And it's the work of Jesus in his life. And what he did for Philip, he's no respecter of person. He can do for anyone in this room, and he will do for anyone in this room. That's not the exception. That's the rule. And maybe you're there today. Maybe you're there. Your heart is crushed. That's okay. It happens. We have our Gethsemanes. But Jesus and Jesus only is able to begin to heal us in those Gethsemanes. And He's willing to. And the Bible said that's why He came. It's not going out of His way for Him to help you. That's why He came. You don't need to apologize. That's why He showed up. For people like me and you who are having heartbreak in our life. You don't have to apologize. He's here. That's what He's about. And He'll help you. He'll help anybody you know. He'll help anybody alive who's willing to humble themselves and say, I am broken, I am beat, I need help, I'm reaching up. Will you reach down? He'll do it for you. Because He's done it for billions and billions of people in this world who could testify as Philip did this morning. Will you stand with me?